AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week's guest is Michael Dykes, President and CEO of the International Milk Producers Federation, who joins the show to discuss raw milk testing for avian flu, how the new dietary guidelines proposal impacts dairy consumption recommendations, and a look ahead to what agriculture may expect from the second Trump administration. But first, here are this week's headlines. Texas farmers will receive 10% of the nearly $10 billion in market relief payments that Congress authorized in its year-end funding bill. According to the latest analysis, farmers in Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, and Nebraska will receive the additional highest amounts by state, respectively. The payments are intended to compensate row crop producers for recent declines in market prices and serve as a bridge to a new farm bill. The legislation signed into law December 21st also provides $21 billion in assistance for losses from hurricanes and other natural disasters, and extends the 2018 Farm Bill for another year. Former President Jimmy Carter, known as the world's most famous peanut farmer, died last week at the age of 100. A native to Plains, Georgia, Carter ran the family's farm supply and seed business and served as governor of Georgia before being elected to the presidency. After leaving office, he founded the Carter Center with his wife, Rosalyn, as a nonprofit organization to promote global public health, alleviate hunger, and work on humanitarian issues. He will lay in state in the U.S. Capitol from January 7th through 9th. Arjun Webster, who worked at USDA during the Carter administration, has an exclusive write-up on the former president's agriculture policy influence on our website. Poultry operations seeking compensation for the losses of birds and eggs due to avian flu will now have to get a biosecurity audit before restocking. According to the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, some poultry farmers continue to face biosecurity challenges and are experiencing multiple infections on their farms. More than 16 million birds had to be depopulated in December, up from about 7 million in November and 4.37 million in October. Also in December, the first severe case of bird flu was identified in a person from Louisiana who had contact with an infected backyard flock. Highly pathogenic avian influenza, commonly known as the bird flu, was first identified in dairy cattle in March, and the virus has since spread across at least 16 states. Last month, USDA expanded its national milk testing strategy. We asked Michael Dykes, President and CEO of the International Dairy Foods Association, how USDA's nationwide milk testing strategy is being implemented to safeguard the food supply, and what additional measures may be needed.
They're expanding the federal order, which was initially implemented on movement of cross-state movement of lactating dairy cows. They've now expanded that, and they will do a 48 national milk testing program. States can opt in. They'll either test milk at milk processing receiving silos or tanker trucks or directly from farm level bulk tanks, depending on the state and depending on the situation and as to the numbers. But the effort will be is any positives will be detected back to the farm and then with a plan to help the farmer understand biosecurity measures, identify particular animals, make sure that they're talking about the employees on the farm, looking after public safety, public health. This will be expanded to all 48 states to do further testing. We're fortunate, Lydia, in dairy, in that we have interlocking safety measures. What do I mean by that? Well, it starts with the pasteurized milk ordinance, which clearly states that milk from sick animals, animals that may have some malady of some sort, should not enter into the bulk tank. We also have a second level of safety as it relates to H5N1 with milk, in that FDA has proven that the pasteurization process destroys the virus that's in milk. We have also worked closely with the broader community, both the layers, the National Milk, the turkey producers, urging USDA to move forward with efforts to identify an effective vaccine. I think there's seven vaccine companies that have candidates out there now. Our view is we don't know what the trajectory of this virus will be. Having been a practicing veterinarian myself in a dairy practice, I know, and I own cows today, I know that we are accustomed to vaccinating our cows for various kinds of viruses. And so I've always felt we need to have a vaccine available so that farmers could have the option. if it was warranted, if they felt it was efficacious, if they felt it was cost effective, to at least have that option available.
With lost dairy production, especially in California recently, should industry and consumers be concerned about dairy supply chain shortages?
Never, never rule out the American farmer. And that holds true for the American dairy farmer. They find a way to produce the milk to meet the market needs. So, so far we've not seen that. Yes, some of the milk production's been down in some of these states when they're going through a heavy infection, but I don't think we'll see supply chain problems as a result of it.
We'll be back with more from Michael Dykes right after this.
These are the farmers and ranchers who help build the America we depend on, and Farm Credit is here for them, supporting rural communities and agriculture with reliable, consistent credit and financial services. In good times and bad, we provide loans to farmers and ranchers, farmer-owned cooperatives, rural home buyers, agribusinesses, and rural infrastructure providers. We help agricultural producers feed the world. Learn more today.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
Welcome back. The most recent Dietary Guidelines scientific report recommends dairy products should be consumed at the low-fat level. We asked Michael Dykes what changes IDFA is recommending for the final report.
We were pleased with some aspects of what the report came out with. They recommended 3 servings of dairy a day, which we were pleased with. They also maintained dairy as its own unique category in the nutrition in my plate, which we were pleased with. They failed to seriously consider the abundance of research that we gave them on the role of milk fat, saturated fats in milk, and its relationship to obesity and to cardiovascular health. We would like to see 2% in whole milk, which is 3.25% milk, added to the dietary guidelines. And we think there's a scientific evidence to support doing that. And we don't think they adequately reviewed that. The system, the process was rather opaque. We really didn't know much about it until the report was issued in December. So we look forward to working with the incoming Trump administration to finalize the dietary guidelines. And one of our major efforts will be to remove the limits on milk fat and include 2% in whole milk, which is 3.25% milk, to skim and 1% milk. It's important. The dietary guidelines are so important, especially to the nutrition programs, school feeding programs. We also want to see some of those programs change with WIC and adding whole milk and 2% back to the WIC program, which is about 6 million moms and children a month.
President-elect Donald Trump has threatened tariffs on Mexico and Canada, 2 of the largest export markets for U.S. dairy products. And of course, he's also threatened to increase tariffs on other countries as well as China. Do you believe that this is more of a negotiating move or something that Trump will actually follow through with?
Our goal and our desire is that President Trump will use those as negotiating tactics. He's a businessman. He's accustomed to negotiating, tough negotiations. So we need to negotiate new trade agreements. So if he uses the threat of tariffs to get us market access and new markets, we would be pleased. Our industry is poised for growth with all the innovation we have. We have $8 billion of new investment in manufacturing capacity. Our dairy farmers are doing some outstanding things on the farms with genetics and nutrition and cow comfort and animal welfare to increase production. We think we're on the verge of a golden era for dairy. And we look forward to working with the Trump administration on some of these key topics, trade being one of those. We want to see the commitments made in the USMCA preserved. And that especially goes to Canada and making sure that they honor their commitments to increase market access, which we have not seen thus far. So we'll be working with the Trump administration, with USTR, to try to get those preserved. And in terms of tariffs as a negotiating tool, we'd like to see new agreements made, trade agreements made with Southeast Asian countries to as a counterbalance to some of China's influence there. And as growing markets for U.S. dairy, and we can diversify our markets by going to some of those Southeast Asia countries. Somewhat related to trade, Lydia, would be the supply chain and our ports. We're concerned about the upcoming January 15th date. We need to get both sides of the table back with the longshoremen and the ports authorities to negotiate an agreement so that we don't have a trade disruption here on January 15th, just as we're changing to the new Trump administration on the 20th.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for your insights, Michael, and thanks so much for joining us.
We'll be back with our panel discussion. But first, Andrew Hunneke has a look at how much of the food dollar goes toward farm production in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
New data from USDA shows how much of the 2023 food dollar goes towards farm production. This chart breaks down the spending of the 2023 food dollar. According to USDA, about 9 cents goes towards farm production. But the farmer's share varies depending on what they produce. Farmers get a bigger share of what shoppers pay for meat, for example. The largest share of the overall food dollar, about 26 cents, go to food services, retail trade like grocery stores, and restaurant supply stores and wholesale trade. Both wholesale and retail trade shares went down on a yearly basis, but they're both above average going back to the mid-90s. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hunneke.
Weeds, razor-thin margins, supply chain disruptions. American farmers need innovative solutions to tackle the threats that impact us all. Their yield is their livelihood, and the food that feeds our families. That shouldn't be on the line. Which is why the Modern Ag Alliance advocates for access to essential crop protection tools, like glyphosate, to keep the future of farming in secure, hardworking hands. Get the facts and see what could be at risk.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Welcome back. The 119th Congress began this week with the swearing-in of members. Lawmakers have a long to-do list this year, including the Senate confirming many Trump administration appointees, passing a new farm bill, and updating the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act before its expiration at the end of the year. We're joined this week by Invariant's Aidan McMillan and Tom Sell, co-founder of Combus, Sell, and Associates. Tom, I'd like to begin with you looking back at the last Congress. Before leaving in December, leaders passed $10 billion in market relief for farmers after multiple proposals. The largest share, about 10%, is expected to go to farmers in your home state of Texas. What impact will those payments make in farm country? And secondly, how does that negotiation process reflect the political climate in Washington going into a new Congress?
It was a huge accomplishment, for Congress to pass that emergency bill with both kind of economic loss-based assistance for the decline in prices, really for row crops that occurred in 24, a drastic decline, and then also disaster assistance for crop losses and hurricane losses and all the like from 23 and 24 crop years, which previously had been left out. All the hopes were on the farm bill. So it was a really significant and important accomplishment. All states, we have a nationwide clientele and we represent a number of groups from all over the nation. And I can tell you the one thing that brings them together and brought all of agriculture together on this was the incredible need in farm country. The fact that inflation, the cost of inputs had gone up so much over the past few years and prices started this decline from peaks in 2022. And there was just a sea of red ink on the country. So this is gonna get a lot of farmers right and at least, if not right, at least willing to go back into the field.
And bringing you into the conversation, a one-year farm bill extension was also included in that year-end spending package. Do you think that lawmakers will use the farm bill passed by the House Ag Committee in the last Congress as
a framework for writing that new bill, or where could you see changes in the future in the Farm Bill rewrite this Congress?
I hope they use it, because we're well overdue for an actual Farm Bill. I think we're verging on year 6.5 or so, and there are people who have been waiting patiently for years to very important fixes to programs. You know, a lot of people think about the commodity programs or the SNAP or the big ticket items, but there are hundreds of programs that impact farmers and the agriculture industry across the country that are unable to be adjusted until we have a Farm Bill. And so I'm hopeful that there are multiple provisions options out there for policymakers to take a look at. Starting from scratch would be not the path I would choose, because there's plenty of work that's already been done, and there's no need to keep wasting additional time restarting the clock over. Obviously, we have new players at the Four Corners table that might change some of the trajectory here, but we've got a lot of farm bills and paper and text out there in the ether that have been worked on for quite some time now, and it's time to get to work and pass one of them.
And as you mentioned, two of those new Four Corners would be Representative Angie Craig and Senator Amy Klobuchar moving into their positions on their respective ag committees. How do you see and those new leaders influencing Farm Bill development differently from Senator Debbie Stabenow and Representative David Scott?
These are two new dynamic faces at the table. I'm very excited for both of them. I do think it's a little bit untested in some ways. I mean, the two, particularly on the Senate side, Senator Stabenow has been a real forceful leader on the Ag Committee for years. And so, you know, I've said that that's always a great opportunity, but an even sometimes better opportunity is having someone like Senator Klobuchar or Congresswoman Craig, who don't have as many firm stances on issues. And it presents the opportunity to be able to retell your story, potentially pick up a new advocate for issues and positions all across the Farm Bill. So I'm excited for that. I definitely think there will be a renewed focus on some of the Minnesota commodities. So that's more your corn and soybeans, as opposed to maybe fruits and vegetables that the Georgia and Michigan perspectives would have brought.
We'll be back with more of our panel discussion right after this.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources. This
is my sustainability story.
Weeds, razor-thin margins, supply chain disruptions. American farmers need innovative solutions to tackle the threats that impact us all. Their yield is their livelihood and the food that feeds our families. That shouldn't be on the line, which is why the Modern Ag Alliance advocates for access to essential crop protection tools like glyphosate to keep the future of farming in secure, hardworking hands. Get the facts and see what could be at risk.
Welcome back. President-elect Donald Trump has outlined many actions during his first 100 days after inauguration, including mass deportations of illegal immigrants. We asked Tom Sell how he thinks this will impact farm operations, especially larger dairies.
I think you've seen a lot of, you know, mixed messages out of the administration. Mixed, not in a bad way, but you know, there are conflicting ideas. Certainly Donald Trump, if anyone knows that we need a stable workforce, certainly he, and you saw Elon Musk, tweeting over the weekend, these legal immigration processes are the reason why he came to the U.S. And many who work for Tesla and X and the other great companies that he manages are here, and why they've been able to achieve success. So certainly this administration knows the need for quality workers and how a legal immigration process is needed to bring those workers. And agriculture is not lost on this administration. So I don't think there needs to be a lot of fear and panic. We know from studies that there are a number of illegals that populate. And of course, the farmers do their job. They collect the information, but there's just a lot of fraudulent, IDs out there in the country. And the farmers aren't expected to be the police. And so it's always it can be a really disconcerting situation when ICE shows up, particularly on a dairy where those cows have to be milked. And I hope they take a sensible approach. You know, if you just trust the administration that they're going to go after kind of the criminals first, those who have committed crimes or are known or have gone through the adjudication process, the people that are known, I think we'll be in a fine place.
And a final question I'll pose to you both, but Anne, you can answer first. Looking into 2025, what do you believe will be the biggest or most influential issues to watch in the agriculture policy space?
I honestly think it's whether or not we can get a farm bill across the finished. I mean, I think Tom and I have been doing this for years. This is my fifth farm bill. I don't know where Tom's is, but every year it gets harder and harder. And I have sort of been sort of talking like, is it too big? Is it carrying too much, like both emotional and like actual legislative weight? And do we need to start looking at some more version like the NDAA, which is done yearly or every other year? I just worry that, again, I work with a lot of people that have smaller, lower tier issues that have been patiently waiting for years and years to get them addressed. And I worry that we're at a point where margins are so thin, fewer and fewer people are representing rural America. They're just out of touch. A little, like members of Congress are just less in touch with what's happening in that those spaces. And are we losing the ability to pass farm bills? And if we are, then we need to think about how to fix that. And there's lots of different ways to do it. My idea to have a smaller farm bill might be one of them, or better education. But I'm just a little concerned that these types of very important yet band-aids that we passed at the end of last session for, you know, economic assistance is what we're looking at for the foreseeable future.
And Tom, the same question for you. What are you watching in 2025?
Well, I love it. I love where Anne's head is, and I agree with everything she said. Farm bill is certainly number one. I think the trade agenda is going to be really interesting. Obviously, there's a lot of talk of tariffs and that, but look, we've got to be more intentional about gaining market access for U.S. producers of all types, especially crops, field crops, row crops, proteins, beef, dairy. There's a lot to be gained there. And you know, Trump's trade policy is a little bit scary, we'll be the first to say, but it's also, it produced some results the last time around. You know, the agreement with China was significant, and then we essentially walked away from it these last 4 years. So it'll be interesting to see where we go there. I think the energy front is really super interesting. Obviously, a lot of programs, a lot of venture capital, a lot of investment in rural America was spurred by the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, which is kind of the signature accomplishment of the previous administration. What's going to be our you know, what's going to be the future of that in an all of the above kind of energy production agenda of the Trump administration? And where does agriculture and biofuels and all those fit into that? It's a really important issue with big implications for rural America.
Wonderful. Well, Tom and Anne, thank you both so much for joining us today.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, Andrew Honecke has a look at crop indemnity payments in this week's Map It Out.
According to USDA's Risk Management Agency, crop indemnity payments are high in multiple areas of the country. Indemnities are paid to farmers when their crop yields come in less than the production guaranteed in the crop insurance policies they purchased. This map shows crop indemnity numbers on a county-by-county basis as of early December. As you might expect, payments are highest where there have been extreme weather events like drought in many western counties and the plains, or flooding in the southeast. Both Hurricane Helene and Milton left generational damage behind in Florida, as well as Georgia and the Carolinas. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
Elevate your game and set your sights on Denver with a 2025 Commodity Classic. With technology that moves faster than fluctuating markets and information as important as a million-dollar rain, Commodity Classic is designed for growers of all kinds, where you'll broaden your horizons as you improve yield and ROI one bushel at a time. Take your operation to new heights and join us for Elevating Excellence in Agriculture, March 2nd through 4th in Denver. Learn more at CommodityClassic.com.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks for joining us on this week's AgriPulse Newsmakers. Next week, both the House and Senate will be in session for the first of 10 full weeks to begin the 119th Congress. We'll have the latest on Capitol Hill developments, confirmation of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet appointees, and all the agriculture policy news you need on our website in the new year. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.